Success Stories. I am Seth Cooper, and the studio is a little filled for the episode, but that is okay. Anytime that Ann and I can welcome a guest into the studio, we have no problem. So, Ann, I'm going to sit back and kind of relax, put my feet up. These chairs are very comfy, so I'm going to take advantage of that. But I'll be here if you need anything. So, Ann, without further ado, we have a special guest in the studio.
Yeah, this episode, I'm really happy to have guest April Wigan. April is the owner of April Fresh Cleaning, based out of Saratoga, and she does work all around the area here. But it just happened that a few months ago, I was talking to somebody about how I was working on a book. And they were like, oh, you need to talk to April Wigan. And they mentioned the business and everything. But like, I hadn't heard that there was somebody in the area that had written a book. And so I kind of put that in the back of my mind. I think there's a Google note in my phone with your name in it. And I didn't get around to reaching out to you. And then at the Adirondack Chambers Women Business Council's last meeting, they were talking about books and podcasts that people should listen to. And April stood up and she showed her book and she said that it was at the North Shore bookstore. And I happened to be in Saratoga and I picked up a copy. So I started reading it. But actually what she even just said in the meeting, I found very inspirational and very aligned with my own thinking. So I said, I have a new best friend now. So we have April Wigan, also known as Trail Gimp, which is the title of her book, Trail Gimp, Self-Discovery and Empowerment on the Appalachian Trail. So welcome, April.
Thanks very much for having me.
So glad to have you. You want to give us just a little bit of a background?
Oh, I have a varied background, and that could take a couple of podcasts. I grew up in Saratoga Springs. That's always been my home. And I grew up, and all I wanted to ever do was teach elementary school. And I worked towards that, and I got my teaching degree, and I settled back home, and there were no jobs. And so I ended up substitute teaching for years and years and years, and without any jobs, somehow I got into hiking, and somehow I learned about the Appalachian Trail, and I just felt like it was something I had to do. So I just told my parents one day, I'm going to go hike the Appalachian Trail. And they said, what? And so I read as many books as I could find. And
this is the 90s.
This is a little bit of internet, but not...
There
was no internet at the end of 95.
I wasn't even born yet. Put that in perspective.
Oops. Yeah. So this is old people. I am old. And so I went to Camp Moore down in New Jersey, and I said, I need boots. I need a backpack. I need a tent. And I walked out with all of my gear within a few hours, which, by the way, is not really the proper way to do things. And I went to go hike the Appalachian. I got a ride down to Georgia, and I started the Appalachian Trail.
And right. And why the Appalachian Trail? Of all the different trails,
it was the only one I had heard of at the time.
And that's sort of north. It's East Coast.
It's East Coast. I've traveled up and down the East Coast a few times. I love to travel, and this was just something that was different. Now, I do love the beach, but going to the beach is expensive. Mm. Hotels are expensive. Motels are expensive. Camping is relatively inexpensive. So given the fact that I didn't have a real job, I had lots of part-time jobs, but I just couldn't afford to be a beach bum. And so I became a trail bum, I guess. And I started my adventure on the Appalachian Trail in April of 1996. And it's been a part of me ever since. So
yeah. So, I mean, your book is fascinating. To admit, I have not had a chance to read the whole thing, but I've read a good bit through it. And just like I said, when you came in here, we needed someone to fix this chair. And I'm like, April could do it. She sounds like she could do anything after what she's been through. I mean, it even started off rough.
It did start off rough because, as I mentioned, I went down to Camp Moore to buy boots. And they said, what size are you? And I said, I'm a size 8. And they said, here you go. And I walked around and I said, okay, these are comfortable. And I bought...
Because that's your shoes.
That's my street size, right. I wear a size 8. And what I did not know, and he did not tell me, I mean, the kid was younger than I was, so I can't really blame him. But you're supposed to buy boots that are a couple sizes too big so that when your feet swell after hiking 10, 15, 20 miles through the mountains while you're carrying a 40-pound pack, your feet are going to swell. So your boots need to have room for your feet to be able to do that. And when your feet swell and you don't have room, you get blisters. Lots and lots and lots of... You get blisters on blisters. My feet looked like hamburger after the first day, and I didn't really understand all of that. But I was out on the trail, and I was going to stay there, and nothing was going to get me off the trail. And people have asked, why did you decide to hike the Appalachian Trail when 90% of the people that attempt it don't finish it? They can't finish it. They have to leave the trail for some reason. And I have no answer for that, because I just felt like I had to be out there. Mm-hmm. My cousin had died in a house fire maybe 6 months before all this. And I just felt like I needed to escape Saratoga. Mm-hmm. I needed something to do. I needed some sort of goal that wasn't teaching, that wasn't working in a mall, that wasn't living with my parents, that wasn't driving a 10-year-old car. I needed something different, and I didn't have any money to do anything with. So somehow the Appalachian Trail became it.
So it was cost effective.
It was cost effective. Once I had all my gear, it was cost effective.
Yeah.
But
she started with, do they call it a trail mate or a hiking buddy? Or
I did start out with a partner. Now, this was pre-internet, so my parents were very nervous about me hiking by myself. And so I contacted the Appalachian Trail Conference because they had message boards and they had somebody that could connect hikers. So through them, I was able to find a hiking partner who lived in Canada. She lived in Ontario. And she was about my age, a year or two younger than me, maybe. And we seemed to get along. We had some phone calls, and we decided to become hiking partners. And that's how I got down to Georgia. Her dad stopped by my house. They spent the night so our parents could meet, so they could realize I'm not hiking with some strange, crazy person, and vice versa. And then I hopped in the car with them and drove all the way down to Georgia. And he dropped us off at the trail and said, okay, see ya. Bye.
But he popped up the next day.
He did. I guess he spent the night in town. And just to be sure, as we crossed the first Forest Service road there, he was waiting for us. And we were like, what are you doing here? He said, before I leave, I just want to make sure you guys are okay and that you really do want to be out here. He said, because if you want to come home, this is your last chance. And we're like, see you later. And I did hike with Megan for a little while. I did give her a pseudonym in the book. I gave everybody pseudonyms.
Yeah. I was curious as to what was what, but I said, okay, it doesn't really matter to me, like, because it's interesting. Tell us a bit about trail names, because the Trail Gimp is yours.
So I was April for a long time. A lot of people adopt trail names, or you're given a trail name based on your idiosyncrasies or something about you, your personality, something that happened. But I just couldn't get used to a trail name. I was April, and that was just who I was. So everybody else started getting trail names, and I was just April. And they're like, no, you have to get a trail name. No. How can I be somebody else? So I just kept hiking. I kept introducing myself as April, and I was limping because of all these blisters. And the blisters were causing other issues. I did end up getting new boots, but my blisters were still there. And I just limped all the time. So somebody just called me Trail Gimp Or there she is gimping down the trail, or I don't remember exactly how it came about, but suddenly I became trail gimp. And I'm like, okay, I'll be trail gimp. I think I was turtle for a couple of days, but there were four turtles on the trail, and I didn't want to be a number, so somehow trail gimp
turtle
came
four,
up.
Turtle four.
Right.
Yeah.
Turtle four is just not. Turtle's a very popular name on the trail.
That's funny.
And so trail gimp became it, and after a while, trail gimp became really cool. Trail gimp got used to talking to strangers. Trail gimp got used to doing things that April would never do.
Because this book is about a lot more than just hiking.
It
is. This is about the whole, like, transformation.
It's a huge transformation.
That you went through.
It's learning. And you don't realize this while you're in the midst of it, which is why the book was written 25 years later. But it's learning self-reliance. It's learning to get through the hard parts. It's learning you have to do things the hard, you know, you have to just do things. So, you know, it's getting rides with strangers for the first time. Like, I grew up in the shadow of the little boy who was abducted.
That one? Or that was New York City?
That was New York City. The kid from Florida. Why can I not think of his name at the moment? But anyway, so we were just taught you don't talk to strangers. You don't get in cars with strangers because if you get into a car with a stranger, automatically they're going to abduct you and kill you. That's just what I was taught. So along the Appalachian Trail, in order to get into town, you hitch rides. There's people that live in the local towns that recognize backpackers and offer them rides into town. And so, I mean, the first time I got a ride into town, I mean, I really wanted to get to town, but I mean, there was this old guy. I didn't know him. You know, he looked like my grandfather. He was very nice and sweet. But again, he was a stranger. So,
was the woman that was kidnapped Jennifer Odom from Florida?
No.
Okay.
I can't even think. Adam. Adam.
Or was
Adam
it,
Walsh.
Or, okay. What? So it wasn't Jimmy. It was Adam.
No, it was Adam Walsh.
Okay.
Adam Walsh was the big, that was like the first major nationwide child abduction that I really remembered. And so I just was always like, okay, don't get a ride with a stranger.
And we kind of instinctively have, like, our survival techniques that we do. So, like, getting in cars with strangers, sleeping in rooms with strangers.
Right. Yes, you do learn to trust your instincts. First, you have to recognize that it's an instinct. And so many people, when they have that sense of fear, they have to recognize either it's your gut instinct telling you something, or you're just afraid to do something new. And so you have to differentiate. Are you afraid of something because, like, you're afraid of dying? Or are you afraid of something because the universe is telling you to pay attention? So
do you think being on the trail and, like, away from your usual life helped you get more in touch with that?
It definitely did. You know, back in 1996, there were no cell phones on the trail, very little technology. I don't even think there were iPads. People carried heavy Walkmans with cassettes. And people would leave cassettes.
How many cassettes are you going to take with
Right,
you,
exactly. Right? And how many times can you listen to the same cassette? So people would leave cassettes in the shelters and then pick up one that somebody else had left. So people were listening to music that whatever people left. And there were a few people that carried, like, weather radios.
Which would be smart.
Which would
be, that's what would worry me.
Right. I remember we were at Blue Mountain Shelter in Georgia, and it's supposed to have this fabulous view. I've been there twice. I've never seen a view. All I've seen are clouds. So I don't know if I believe that there's a view. I've never seen it. But I remember Spot being in the shelter, you know, claiming, oh, guys, get in the shelter. There's a tornado warning in the area. And we're like, oh, Oh, isn't that lovely? This is North Georgia in April, and the weather is so iffy. So we were huddled in the shelter, just, you know, we were fine. It did rain. It rained a lot, but we didn't have a tornado come through. But it was nice to have that little warning. You do learn to read the weather. I didn't carry a radio, but you kind of, you notice the birds and all the animals, you know, when they're running around like crazy and then all of a sudden they're quiet and they're gone. You're like, oh, okay, they know something that we don't know. So it's get to shelter and you just start learning to read the woods. You could feel the moisture in the air before it comes. You can almost smell the rain. For anybody that's hiking with arthritis, they swear they can feel it before it comes. So you listen to them. Mm-hmm. And you just develop these instincts and you learn to listen to them. So
that's amazing.
It is. And until you're out there, it's really difficult to explain that. So.
And there's like a whole community, a whole new community of people that you meet, and they come and they go, and then you meet back up with them again. That seems so fascinating.
It is fascinating because people ask me to this day, aren't you afraid to hike by yourself? And I was like, well, it's like going to school on the first day of school by yourself. You're walking into the door alone, and then you sit in a classroom with 30 other people. And you have lunch with a few people that you recognize. And by the end of the day, you have a whole bunch of friends. And on the trail, if you're sleeping in shelters, you're sleeping next to strangers. Literally nose to nose next to strangers. The worse weather it is, the more people are in the shelters.
You're all packing in there.
You're all packing in there like sardines.
You're not going to leave somebody out in the rain.
So you get to know people really, really quickly. Even though you don't know their name, you're using trail names at this point. You don't know their name. You don't know what they did for a living. You don't know if they're married. You don't know a lot about their personal aspect, but you know if they're a good person. You could figure that out really fast.
Mm-hmm.
So what you did in your life off the trail doesn't matter. It doesn't come up.
You said people didn't tend to talk about that stuff.
We just don't. We talk about blisters. We talk about food. We talk about gear. Talk about how far it is to the next shelter, how hot it is, how cold it is. You know, who's thirsty and you're so tired of water at this point, you just want a Coke or a beer or something else. You talk about trail stuff. You don't talk about your life at home as a teacher or a lawyer or a doctor. And to be fair, as a substitute teacher, there is no way I would have had any confidence to talk to a doctor or a lawyer. I just felt like they were out of my league. But then I found out I was hiking alongside Growler for months before I found out he was a corporate attorney.
Mm-hmm.
And as soon as I found that out, I looked at him in a completely different light. And then I couldn't really talk to him. And then he's like, what is up with you? I'm like, I just found out you're a corporate attorney. And he goes, so? He goes, I actually quit. I'm not doing that anymore. I was like, oh. So he's still Growler the hiker.
Mm-hmm.
But somehow, knowing his background, it kind of skewed what I thought about him. And so it's kind of weird like that. So we don't talk about our lives at home. It's, I mean, you've got to be really close with someone because there's only so much you can talk about the weather and food and gear. So once you get to know people really well, that's when your personal lives come in. But they're all just hikers. They're all out there doing the exact same thing you are. And you find a kindred bond pretty instantly. I remember being in Franklin, or was I in Franklin? No, I was in Hiawassee, Georgia, and one of my friends was having a birthday, and I was like, how are we going to get him a birthday cake when he's right next to me? So we looked across the store and we found some other hikers, and you just knew they were hikers, just the way they were dressed, their boots. I mean, who wears big heavy hiking boots into the grocery store? And so I ended up asking them to buy a cake. You know, I gave them money and they bought a cake, so my friend was he had no idea. Mm-hmm. But you just know hikers. You just see each other across the store and you're like, yeah, you're hiking the Appalachian Trail. I can tell.
We talk about how even the townspeople would embrace the hikers, like the ones were that were right on the trail.
They kind of have to because we're going to be there anyway. Hikers get really tired after a few days out in the woods. You know, 5-6 days of eating trail food, which is macaroni and cheese and tuna fish and whatever freeze-dried creations you want to make. Now, this was 25 years ago, so they didn't have a lot of the stuff that they have now. But when you hear that there's a town only a couple miles away, you're like, oh my gosh, food, a hotel or a motel or a hostel and a shower, and I can wash my clothes. And so hikers are there. And there have been more trail towns that have been bracing the Appalachian hikers.
They even came upon a festival.
I remember my first festival was in 96. It was the day I was leaving the trail in 96 because I was so injured and I had somebody offered me a ride home and I just decided to take it. But we came across the Parrisburg Town Festival, and it wasn't so necessarily an Appalachian Trail Festival, but the trail goes right through, and they had timed the festival to coincide with a whole bunch of hikers. So we were all there, and that was fun. But the big festival is Damascus, Trail Days in Damascus. They have Trail Days every year. It's now the weekend after Mother's Day every year. And it's time to coincide with a whole bunch of through hikers coming through. They've got vendors selling stuff. They've got vendors fixing things. I ran into the Gregory representative, and he saw my Gregory backpack. And I mentioned it. You know, was rubbing funny. So he's like, bring it to me and, you know, I'll help you fix it. And he did, and he didn't charge me anything. So they've got a whole, it's like a big reunion. People come back for it. I've been back to Trail Days a few times since I first started hiking. And it's a reunion every year. They have a hiker parade. You line up with all the other hikers of your year. And you walk through town and the entire town comes out for it. People, they're... the 98 hikers had our 25th anniversary this past year, and we were walking through town. There were a whole bunch of us, and there are people cheering us on. 95-year-olds were out there, older people. There were kids out there, and now it's become a fun thing. The little kids were throwing water balloons, and we were throwing them back, and it became a very active walk. It was a lot of fun. But the townspeople really do embrace the hikers.
Yeah.
For the most part.
I see these days, because I do a lot of work with tourism, they're looking for any angle to get people to their towns. So
right.
That's part of it, too. But I think that because of the nature of the Appalachian Trail, too, it's just... there's something that they're going to embrace.
Right. We tend to spend a lot of money in town.
Yeah.
there is one town that is notoriously not welcoming to hikers. I'm not going to mention the name of the town because I don't want them to come after me.
Mm-hmm.
But let's just say it's in Connecticut. The trail runs through the town. And there's a lot of wealthy residents.
Mm-hmm.
And by the time through hikers get to Connecticut, after they've hiked, 1,300 miles. We're not pretty. The guys probably haven't shaved in 3 months. We've all lost a lot of weight, so we eat a ton of food in town. You know, it's past the halfway point, so we're running out of money, so we don't have a ton of money to spend in their town. And so they just don't like the hikers. They don't embrace us. They don't want us in there. And, you know, we always run into that town in order to resupply, get some food, get your mail drop at the local post office, and then get out of town as quickly as you can.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned that on the first attempt, you didn't make it all the way. So what brought you to stop?
Well, I was really slow, and I was limping. All the blisters caused me to limp. I think I did stop in one local hospital. It was was the hospital that was in the movie Deliverance.
Yeah, you mentioned that in the book.
And there were pictures on the wall, and it was really kind of freaky. But the doctor basically said, yeah, I think you've pulled your ligaments in your feet, and you should stop hiking. And
so it wasn't just the blisters. It was worse
Was really bad. That my feet were so messed up. And sometimes they're still a little messed up. I can notice my feet when I walk. I'll notice my ligaments getting tight, or I'm like, okay, I need to take a break. But I didn't do that, you know, because I was going to finish, because I was determined and stubborn. But I was really slow. I had skipped around a little bit on the trail. It wasn't the through hike that I thought it was going to be. And I really was afraid that I was causing permanent damage. A lot of my trail friends were like, trail gimp, go home. They were all saying, telling me to go home. So I was hiking with a girl named Twin Bears, and her father was coming to pick her up to take a week or two off the trail, and they lived in Massachusetts. So they said, we're driving right by Albany if you want to ride home. And I thought about it for a couple of days, because at first I said, nope, absolutely not. I'm going to keep hiking. I was taking so much ibuprofen, more than was healthy. It wasn't helping. My foot was swollen, and it was just bad. And I said, you know, maybe I really should listen to some common sense for the first time in a while. And I did end up coming home. But I wasn't happy at home. I was back to substitute teaching. There were still no jobs. I was working in the mall again.
How long were you on the trail at that point?
I had only hiked 400 miles. I was gone for about 2 months.
2 months.
And my parents were thrilled to have me back. But I felt like I got stuck in the same rut.
Mm-hmm. Nothing had changed, really, at that
nothing
point.
Had changed. My mind had changed.
It was worse, probably.
It was. I mean, I had only wanted to teach in Saratoga Springs because that's where I grew up and that's all I really looked at. And I found out later on I'm a terrible interviewer. So, like, there were a few job applications I put in, and I did have one or two interviews, and I was terrible. And, so, of course, I didn't get those jobs. So, but hiking the trail made me realize that there really is life outside of New York State. And people actually live in other states, and they work in other states. And it was really my first experience of living with people that lived elsewhere. Mm-hmm. So in a roundabout way, I moved to Charlotte, North Carolina with nary a thought. Like, my sister's friend needed a roommate. I said, okay, they need teachers down there, and I need a place to go, and I need something to do. And so I moved to North Carolina. And the Appalachian Trail was put out of my mind as far as through hiking. I did find out teaching was, I got a job right away. It was in a field that I wasn't certified for. And I think I got the job because I mentioned that I liked North Carolina, and I had hiked the Appalachian Trail in North Carolina. And the principal says, oh, you must be really tough. We need tough people like you. And he offered me the job within mm-hmm. half an hour. And I took it. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't the job for me. So I used to drive to the mountains on the weekends all the time. I was out there hiking trails. It was my escape from the real world. Mm-hmm. And that's when I met a guy named Darren, and I don't remember his pseudonym in the book either. I just met him out in the woods. I was hiking a 25-mile section that I had skipped in North Carolina, and I took a liking to him. We took a liking to each other, and we hiked. He offered to drive me back to my car, and we ended up having lunch in the meantime, and I just really liked this guy. We would... You know, there was no email back then. There was no Facebook. There was no way to keep in touch other than to send an actual letter. Okay. So I sent
telephone,
him a...
Telephone, maybe.
Right. But if you didn't know the phone number.
All right.
So I sent him a note, and I thanked him for driving me back to my car and thanking him for lunch. And I did include my phone number in that And so he called me, and we had a couple phone calls. Finally, we decided to go on a date in the woods. We camped.
In the woods.
Yeah. We had a hiking date for a weekend. And my friends cracked up because they're like, only you could go out into the woods by yourself and come out with a date. And so that's been a long-running joke with all of my friends. But Darren was going to hike the Appalachian Trail in 98. And I'm like, well, that's nice. Good luck. You know, I'm teaching. But I really didn't like my job. And even though I had gotten a different job, I didn't like the job. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't for me. And nothing was going well. And he's like, you can hike with me. I'm like, I'm not going to hike with you. But it did open the idea of, well, if I do want to go back to the trail, you know, my lease is ending. My car doesn't have a car payment. I don't have many supplies. You know, I could put everything in storage. And the more I thought about it, the more it made sense. So I told my roommate, I'm sorry, I'm going to leave the end of March and I'm going to go hike the Appalachian Trail again. And I had to tell my parents.
What'd they think?
I didn't really give them time to answer. I called them up and I said, well, thank you very much for the college degree. Thank you for paying for my teaching degree. But I've decided I'm going to quit teaching and I'm going to take a temp job to save some money. And then I'm going to go hike the Appalachian Trail. And I can tell you really don't want to talk about this right now. So I'll talk to you later. Click.
Bye.
I mean, I think I avoided their phone calls for like a week or two.
How old were you at this point?
I was 27 when I called them.
Yeah.
And, you know, it seems irresponsible sometimes when I think back, going, if I would kill my kid if they called me and told me that. but I just felt like it was something I had to do. It was a calling. It wasn't a choice. It was just something I had to do. So off I went, and I had some friends drive me out to the trail in Georgia and dropped me off, and off I went. And
so what did you do differently?
Well, I did prepare in 98. There was one little tiny mountain called Catawba Mountain, or no, Crowder's Mountain. It was about half an hour from Charlotte, where I lived. So I would go out there on the weekends, and I would climb up, and I would climb down. And sometimes I would climb up and down and up and down in the same day.
Because you'd done no training really before the first attempt.
I did no training. I threw on a 40-pound pack and I hit the woods.
Too tight shoes? And
too tight, yeah. So I did a little bit more research. I realized my synthetic sleeping bag was too heavy. So I sold that and bought a down sleeping bag. I went through all of my gear to figure out what was too heavy, what I was going to keep. So I did some shifting around of gear. I definitely got new. Well, I had gotten new boots in 96, but I had worn them for a lot of hiking. So I got another pair and broke those in just in case. So I would have two pairs if I needed one. I just did a lot of walking. I went out to that mountain on the weekends. I walked around my apartment complex. I walked around barefoot so I could toughen up the soles of my feet, which I don't know if I recommend. but I mean, I used to throw 60 pounds in my backpack. I go into the kitchen and put in all the canned goods and a whole bunch of just whatever I could find in there to make it heavier. So I was practice hiking with 60 pounds on my back, and I think I weighed about 140 at the time, which is a lot of weight to carry.
Yeah, like half a year of weight.
It was almost half my body weight. And they recommend, you know, when you're through hiking, 20 to 30% at the max.
Oh, wow.
So when I finally did start hiking, I shed all that extra weight, and I think my pack weighed about 40 pounds, 40, 45 in the beginning. I did pare it down a little bit more. But I was prepared for it. I knew the rigors of Georgia. Georgia's really tough. Georgia doesn't believe in too many switchbacks, so it goes up the mountain and down the mountain. And so a lot of people quit in Georgia, but I had already hiked through Georgia. I knew what it was going to be like, so I was all set. and I had just given up my career and my apartment, and I was technically homeless. And so, you know, once I made that decision, I was out there. I wasn't getting off that trail until Maine.
You were determined.
I was very
Even
determined.
More than you were the first time.
And, you know, I had learned some lessons. So, and I had more friends, and I had a little bit more money than I did the first time. So,
You saved up from your temp job.
I did. I had just enough money, but, you know, I still, I tend to hike in the woods, and I look up at the sky and the clouds, and I look at the animals, and I look at the birds, and I'm not looking down at the tree roots and the holes in the ground. And so
they could trip you up.
I mean, I can't spend 5 minutes on a trail without tripping. It's just my nature. And so I twisted my ankle. I pulled my muscles, and just about every muscle in my leg was pulled at one point. And I just, I continued limping along. And it's just the way it was.
But you made it through.
I did.
All the way to Maine.
I did make it through to Maine. Lots of, it was a very different trail from 96. I met somebody who I thought was going to be the love of my life, and I chased him through Virginia. And that's how I pulled my hip flexor, which really slowed me down. I ended up taking 2 weeks off in Pennsylvania at a shelter, and my parents thought I was missing. And they ended up calling the Appalachian Trail Conference, who told them to call the regional Appalachian Trail Conference in Pennsylvania. And they spoke to Allgood, and Allgood said, no, no, she was through here 2 weeks ago. And they're like, well, she's not where she's supposed to be in Pennsylvania. And so, oh, somewhere in there, they called the state police trying to find me. And Allgood ended up having to hike out, and he found me at a shelter after I'd been there for about 10 days. And
so you just stayed
I just stayed there. This is what makes communication among the trail amazing, because there, again, none of us had cell phones. If you wanted to contact somebody, you actually sent a letter and you put it in the mailbox. So people were getting to the shelter and I was still there. And so gossip spread up and down the trail that Trail Gimp was stuck in the shelter. So, you know, it was Trail Gimp, and then it just became a hiker. So people who were leaving Duncannon and coming into the shelter were bringing an extra day's worth of food. So I had planned to stay there 3 or 4 days, and then I was going to have to hike out. But people kept bringing me food. And so with all this food, I didn't have to leave. And then some, there was a teenage girl who was doing some trail running. She would bring me newspapers and some snacks every couple of days. And then there was some guy, can't think of his name. He walked in the shelter. He had coolers and a backpack, and he says, are you Trail Gimp? Yes, I am. He goes, well, these are for you.
That's amazing.
And he says, I ran into your friends Cool Rabbit and a couple other hikers, and they said you were stranded here. And he says, and no hiker is going to starve on my watch. And he drops coolers full of soda and ice and food. And he says, if you run out of food and you need more, you have somebody call me and I'll come right back. And I was like, wow. So I was in that shelter for 12 days until Allgood pretty much threatened, you either need to hike out or you need to be evacuated.
But you kept on going.
I kept on going, and I hiked at a mile an hour. And it took a while. My hip eventually healed when I got to Maine. But I limped the entire time. And by this time, I was kind of hiking by myself. But I knew everybody. I knew everybody on the trail.
And they're passing, or you're meeting up with them at the shelter.
Right. They would pass me during the day, or they would stay in town, and I would pass them, and or I would stay in town, and they would catch up. And so you flip-flop up and down the entire Appalachian Trail. And you develop your trail family, and, you know, everybody kind of watches out for everybody. So,
so how long did it take overall to get to Maine?
Overall, it took me about 6.5 months.
So 6.5 months on the trail mostly.
But I took 2 weeks off in Pennsylvania, mm-hmm. and I took 2 weeks off when I was in Tennessee. My grandmother had passed away. I'd gotten word of that, so I flew home for her funeral.
Because it's not like a marathon that you start and you go straight through. It's like people come off and on. And
right. And everybody has their own thru-hiker rule. So, you know, I just wanted to make it to Maine. People get off the trail for weddings, graduations.
That's a long time.
Some people run the trail and they've got their, you know, everybody has their own little agenda. Mm-hmm. And it's all okay.
Because it's your own...
It's your own hike.
It's your own goal, what you want to get out of it.
There's a saying out there, it says, hike your own hike. Mm-hmm. I really wanted to keep up with Little Bus. I wrote about him in my book a lot. He was the one I really wanted to be with. I thought he was my end-all and be-all. But he's 6 inches taller than me. Mm-hmm. His legs are a foot longer. He hikes 4 miles an hour. And as much as we got along, we had a lot in common, I could not keep up with him. And trying just got me injured. So
yeah,
I just realized, you know, he can hike his hike and I have to hike my own hike. And so.
So 6.5 months, you're back to reality. What was that like?
The weirdest part was realizing that in order to go to the bathroom, you needed to find a public restroom.
That was funny. And you were in Saratoga, back in Saratoga?
I did. My parents picked me up in Maine. We had relatives in northern Maine, so we stayed there for a couple of days. And then we took our time getting back home. We stopped at the beach for a day. We went shopping for a day. I had dropped a lot of weight and nothing I had fit. I was down to a size 6 and I had like 0 body fat and I had my high school reunion to go to. So I was in town for a few weeks. And a friend of mine introduced me to his friend. His name was Brian, and Brian and I got along great. We went on a couple of dates, but I'm like, sorry, dude, I live in North Carolina.
So you wanted to go back to North Carolina?
I did. I loved living in Charlotte. I loved the weather. I'm not a winter girl. I do not like the snow and the cold. And so I did end up going back to Charlotte. And Brian just kept calling and I came home for Thanksgiving. I came home for Christmas. He picked me up at the airport and then I met his family and then we met halfway for Valentine's Day. And then I realized that was going to go somewhere. So, but it wasn't going to go anywhere if I was living in Charlotte. Mm-hmm. So, and my whole family was home, back in Saratoga. My sister was pregnant with her first child. And I really didn't want to be the absentee aunt. You know, I wanted to be able to pick up my niece or nephew and not have them cry because they didn't know who I was. So I somehow made the decision. I left Charlotte and I came back to Saratoga. And by this time, though, I didn't want to teach anymore. Mm-hmm. So
what did you decide to do?
Back living with my parents again, this time at the age of 28, turning 29. The good thing is I actually get along with my parents. So, you know, at this point it was just kind of a room. And, you know, I would help clean and help cook and all that. So it's not like I was one of those kids smooching off my parents. But I still joke about it. But I didn't know what I was going to do. I didn't know what I wanted to do. I didn't know what I was qualified to do. Mm-hmm. Somebody offered my mom a job cleaning an office once a week. She used to do some cleaning in her spare time. And it was something that I had always done as a third or a fourth job. Mm-hmm. We were just really good at it. And so she says, no, I don't want that cleaning job, but maybe April does because she don't have a job. She doesn't know what she wants to do. And she has a car payment she needs to make. So I took this job cleaning an office and it was fine. You know, it was simple enough. They paid me well. And then I did end up getting what I call a real job during the day, you know, 9 to 5 in an office doing finance work. And I liked that too. But the cleaning was just, it was something I was going to end up leaving. And then I got engaged. So then I kept cleaning to help pay for the wedding. And then they expanded their hours and they just hired more people. So they needed more cleaning. And then they gave my name out to some friends. And then I just started cleaning.
Yeah.
I just started for cleaning everybody in Albany and Saratoga. And within a few years, I was making more money cleaning than I was at my day job. Mm-hmm. And
without a big master plan, it just kind of organically
developed. It just sort of came about. That first office that I cleaned, I was friends with some of those people. And they're the ones who said, you should turn this into a business. And I was like, yeah, I don't know how to do that. They're like, you don't need to know how to do it because you're doing it.
Mm-hmm.
So I was like, okay. So I went and got a DBA. And a couple years later, I turned it into an S Corp.
Mm-hmm.
And I left my day job and I just started a full-scale cleaning company.
Mm-hmm.
And 25 years later, here I still am.
Right.
And that's I did not make a master plan.
Mm-hmm.
It just sort of happened, kind of happenstance. It's what the universe wanted, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And it was great for me because, you know, I could go to my kids' events at school during the day.
Yeah.
And I could maneuver my schedule around a little bit. And so it's worked out well for me.
You've got control of your own destiny.
I do.
How many people work with you?
We have about 20 part-time employees, one full-time person in the office, which enables me to get out and about during the day a little bit.
Mm-hmm. What's the biggest challenge you have?
Biggest challenge is keeping staff.
Mm. That seems to be most people's biggest challenge.
It is. The type of cleaning that we do, I mean, it's office cleaning. It's not incredibly difficult, but we tend to be a little bit more thorough. And so it's work.
Yeah.
And people come in, they're like, oh, I thought I was just going to be wiping things down
mm-hmm.
and taking out trash. And so you are wiping things down, but you're cleaning behind things also.
Yeah.
So, you know, and when we vacuum, we have to get in the corners. You can't just vacuum the common area, the main area. You have to clean the baseboards. And so some people don't stick mm-hmm. very long because they realize it is actual hard work. And then, you know, circumstances change. They have kids, they move, they get married,
yeah.
you know. I've gone from full-timers to part-timers, back to full-time, back to part-time. I've changed the way I do things a few different times.
Mm-hmm.
We've changed the supplies that we use. And the other big difficult part is, now that everybody has cell phones and you're on your cell phone all the time, clients expect, you know, if they have a question, they expect an answer instantly. So you're always working. There's never any downtime. Even if I have staff out and about, I'm always working.
Mm-hmm.
I'm always ready to be there, which makes relaxing difficult.
Yeah. That is tough, especially because, like, if they're cleaning out of hours.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, so the alarm goes off. They don't
yeah.
know what to do. We discuss it just in case. But, you know, there's always a question. There's always an emergency. There's something is breaking. You know, they have their mop and it just broke. And, you know, what do they do? And so it's just all of those phone calls, the 400 emails a day. There's, you know, somebody's always sick or on vacation. And with COVID, it's made it worse. So, you know, it's who's going to be a backup for that
yeah.
company, for that office. And so sometimes I'm the backup, and lately I've been the backup a lot lately. So it's just the crazy schedule can be very challenging.
Mm-hmm. I can imagine.
But it's just one of those, you just can't quit. There's always, mm-hmm. like hiking, you have to get to Katahdin. You've got to make
mm-hmm.
it. Everybody has been in your position at least once.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, find somebody that you can ask questions.
Mm-hmm.
There's always somebody out there that can help you.
Yeah.
You just need to find out who it is. You have to ask questions. You can't let your ego get in the way.
Yeah.
You know, and you can't. The big thing is just ask the question.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody's going to think you're stupid. Like in school, people
mm-hmm.
Kids don't want to ask. Even
right.
though you see on their face that confused look mm-hmm. that they don't get what you're trying to teach them.
And half the people probably also have the same
right.
question.
And you ask them, do you get it? And they're like, uh-huh. And you know they don't.
And then next time it's like, no.
Right. So I think teaching has helped me to understand that a little bit, mm-hmm. that even though people say they understand, many times they don't. Mm-hmm. And you just have to go over it in a different way until you finally see their eyes light up of, yep. oh, right. now
the
I get it.
The light bulb goes off.
The light bulb goes off. So, you know, training is like that too. And it's just getting people to believe that they're part of something bigger.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just them trying to get a paycheck. It's mm-hmm. they're part of a bigger community.
Yeah. And those are the kind of people you want working with you.
Yes.
Yeah.
Sometimes it takes a little to convince them of that.
Yeah. if you treat them well, then they start to feel that.
Right. You know, especially some of the staff coming in, they come from challenging environments. I mean, I had one girl, I asked her, why are you cleaning? She goes, well, this is all I could do. I said, what do you mean this is all I could do? Well, I'm not comfortable around money, so I don't want to work in retail. And I'm a little nervous, so I don't like to work with the public a lot. Mm-hmm. And she had it in her brain that all she could do was cleaning. And first of all, I had to convince her that cleaning is a noble job. You know, mm-hmm. it's hard work and you get paid well for it. Yeah. So there's nothing wrong with it. And second of all, you can put your, if you can dream it, you can do it.
Yeah.
So I know one girl, she wanted to get her high school GED. And I said, so why don't you get it? Well, I don't know how. I'm like, oh my goodness, I will call the place to find you the place you need to mm-hmm. go. I will pay the fee for you
mm-hmm,
in order for you to get your GED, because mm-hmm. that's kind of an important thing. And you can't be a nurse. Oh, no, I could never be a nurse. Didn't you just say you wanted to be a nurse?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah, but I can't be a nurse.
Right.
Well, why can't you be a nurse? You just don't have the education now. You just need to go to school to get it.
Mm-hmm.
But some of these people, they just don't believe they
because they've not been around that atmosphere. Like,
right.
I'm a big sister, like big brothers, big sisters.
Oh,
and
yes.
that's part of the whole ethos of it is, you know, having somebody that's done these other things to give kids
right.
like a role model and guidance on doing things that they might not otherwise
right.
see.
I remember when I was teaching I was teaching fourth grade, and we had to talk about the physical differences of North Carolina, the mountains, the ocean. And so I had taken some pictures from a 96 hike, and I showed it to them, and I said, this is the Georgia-North Carolina border along the Appalachian Trail. And some of these kids, they were from the inner city, and they had never traveled outside of Charlotte. And they looked at this picture, and they said, there's not a fence.
Oh, wow, yeah.
And I was like, nope. You can just walk straight from Georgia you can walk from one state to another.
Mm-hmm.
And they just couldn't believe that.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, you guys are 20 miles from South Carolina and you've never been there.
Mm-hmm.
So,
it's opening up the world.
It's really opening it up to have people understand that
mm-hmm.
there's somebody out there that can help them. And,
mm-hmm.
So, and then just hiking all of that way has taught me you can do anything you want. Whatever fears you have, somebody has worked through them.
Mm-hmm.
So somebody is out there to help you.
Not being afraid to
right.
accept the help of others, to ask for help.
Right. I think the big thing is understanding that you're not alone.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody out there has done whatever mm-hmm. you're afraid to do, and they'll help you.
Yeah.
I mean, I grew up in Saratoga, so people I grew up with, people would rent out their house during track season. And my husband didn't want to do that when we bought our house. But I said, okay, well, I would like to have rental property. I don't know how to buy rental property. I don't have money to just, you know, go out and buy another house. So mm-hmm. I'm having a hard enough time with this house. And so my mom worked with somebody who she bought rental property, and mm-hmm. she, by the time, within 6 or 7 years, she had 6 or 7 houses.
Mm-hmm.
So I sat down with her. I said, how do I do this?
Mm-hmm.
So she taught me. And the finance rules were a lot different before 2008 than they are now.
Mm-hmm.
and I don't know if it's quite as simple now, but she taught me how to take the equity in my house and put a down payment on a duplex. Mm-hmm. And so I'm like,
okay.
So
it's just not being afraid to ask for help?
It's not being afraid to ask for help. And, you know, there is some risk involved. You have to be able to accept some sort of risk.
Yeah. I guess it's balancing out the risk versus reward, right?
Right.
Like with doing a 6.5 month trail hike.
Yes.
That you didn't die.
That I didn't die.
Though your feet aren't the same.
My feet are not the same. My feet did grow half a size.
Wow.
My arch isn't quite as tall as it used to be. And...
Because it's extreme.
It is extreme. But, you know, people always ask, would you go out there and do it again? And at first I said, absolutely no. Now, I was curious. Last week I looked up one of the girls I hiked with a little bit on the trail. She was faster than I was. So I looked her up. I Googled her. And I hadn't heard from her since 98. So this is 25 years later. After she finished the Appalachian Trail, she has hiked 14,000 miles. She has done all the long-distance trails in America. She's hiked some trails I've never even heard of. She's a, you know, she's a nurse, and so she travels, she does travel nursing.
Oh, okay.
And that's how she makes her money, and then she goes hiking for a while. 14,000 miles.
I was going to ask you if you kept in touch with anybody to this day that you hiked with.
Facebook has made it easier. So yes, I am now in, when I first started writing about my journey, it was back in 2007, Facebook wasn't out yet, or maybe it was.
Just starting out. It was probably the Farmingville era and poking era.
But the internet was around, and I think there was something called MySpace or something. Anyway,
MySpace and Bebo.
I did find some friends in 96 when, so it was 2007. I was writing about my hike, and I would call people on the day that I met them.
Oh.
I'm like, hey, I met you today, you know, 8 years ago, or whatever it was. And because of Facebook, we've all become friends. And so I do keep in touch with a lot of people, but not initially. You know, I just, it was a separate part of my life.
Able to find them. Yeah. And now you've written the book. So that kind of opens it up. To going back to that in a way.
And it's realizing that it's not a separate part of my life. It's it's a very big part of my life. And I just compartmentalized it for so long.
Yeah.
But it really is who I am. I was a lot more shy before I hiked. You know, I was, as I mentioned with Growler, once I learned he was a corporate attorney, I looked at him differently. So I was big into titles. And if somebody had a certain title, and I didn't have a title, so you know, I just looked at people differently, and I was afraid to talk to certain people, and I always felt people were judging me, and I realized that is so not true. And you know, people do judge, but I don't care anymore.
Right.
I'm not worried. Back then, I was worried if my pants were too short. You know, I don't care about that anymore. I'm not a fashionista person. You know, I'm pretty basic. And I'm okay with that. I don't think I've worn I used to not be able to go down to the mailbox without having a shower, blow drying my hair, curling my hair, and putting makeup on. Like, I would not walk out the door until I was 100% done. And I haven't worn makeup in 20 years. I mean, maybe for special occasions, but even...
You know yourself, you know what's important to you.
And that's it. I've learned who I am, what I'm comfortable with. And I'm not out there to impress anybody and, you know, clients, yes, but it's...
But you impress them in other ways.
Right.
You impress them with your work.
Right. And I'm very, very comfortable in my skin. So I became a lot like Trail Gimp on the trail.
Yeah.
I incorporated a lot of who she was and some really cool things about her. And whatever I didn't like about me, I just kind of left.
That's so exciting.
It was, it like is very exciting.
You can... you can develop your own persona the way you want to be.
Right. It's not, hey, this is who I am and I'm stuck with it.
You don't need permission. Or,
right. Yeah. Who do I want to be? What do I want to do? What do I want to accomplish? And if I don't know how to do that, then all I have to do is ask somebody. Mm-hmm. And that's the big takeaways of the entire book.
I wanted to wrap it up with the epilogue. You have some amazing points that I think are really important and in line with what this podcast is all about. So take the first step, number one, because that's what you got to do to get going, right?
You always have to take the first step. You can think about things and dream about things. You can, you know, I want to get a tiny house. I want to travel. But you have to buy the ticket. You know, if you want to go to Europe, you have to get a plane ticket or a boat ticket or something. You have to get there.
You need to get it out of your head. And
right. You
forward.
Need to stop thinking about things and actually do the one thing that's going to set you on that path. So
don't be afraid. You've discussed that a few times, right?
Right.
Yep.
I mean,
what's the worst that could happen?
Right. What's the worst that can happen? You fail, so you start again.
Yep. And you learn your lesson. Listen to your gut instinct and your inner voice.
That's very important. That will keep you safe for the most part.
Guide you the
way. It will guide you as to where you need to go. So,
think big, positive, and take a chance at something great. I love that.
You have to.
Whether it's doing the Appalachian Trail or starting your own business or getting your GED.
Or moving out of your parents' house when it's nice and safe and free and buying your own house. I mean, there's always challenges. There's always going to be something bigger and better to try. And all you can do is try.
Just keep trying. Chances are someone has gone through what you were going through. They survived and so will you.
That was a big one I thought about when I was on the Webster Cliffs in New Hampshire. I was literally stuck on a cliff, and I thought...
No. That would be my nightmare.
It was a nightmare. I really thought I was going to die, and I sat there for like 20 minutes debating. I can't go up, and I can't go down, and I'm just going to fall off this mountain. And then I remembered that Earl Schaefer had hiked the trail that year. He was celebrating his 50th anniversary, and he was 79 years old. And it occurred to me, I'm like, if he can hike up this trail, I'm going to have to find a way. If he can do it at 79 years old, and all these other hikers have done it, they're ahead of me. I'm like, if they can do it, I can do it too. And it was really scary letting go of that rock to be able to try to reach up to the next handhold. I mean, I really did think I was going to die. But it was either go back down and go home or move forward. And if Earl Schaefer could do it, then I could too.
Wow. That's amazing.
So there's always a way.
Temper tantrums and self-pity don't solve problems.
Oh my gosh. That comes from Purple. I lost the trail in Virginia and I couldn't find a path. And I searched everywhere and I ended up wasting an hour walking in circles, and I threw the biggest temper tantrum, and I'm yelling and screaming at the top of my lungs, and these are all four-letter words, and I'm all by myself, and I'm sure I looked like an idiot, but I didn't care. And then Purple walked in, and he's like an 18-year-old kid with purple hair, and he's like, Truggin, what's the problem? I'm like, I can't find the trail. And he just walked, and within 8 seconds, he goes, oh, it's right over here.
Because you're not thinking clearly when you're
don't think clearly
like that.
Yeah. So all I did was waste a whole lot of energy and made a fool out of myself and solved absolutely nothing. So I don't generally have temper tantrums anymore. So, you know, when my kids had temper tantrums, I'm like, okay. You know, I was one of those parents that were like, it's not a reflection on me. You're 2 years old, have a temper tantrum, and eventually you'll get exhausted and you'll stop. So...
Oh, recognize wants versus needs.
That was a big one when you're hiking because you want a steak, but you need food. So anywhere you are, you want something, but what you need is basically very simple. Mm-hmm. You want a mansion on a lake or overlooking an ocean, and you want staff to run it for you, but what you really need is just somewhere safe to sleep. Mm-hmm. Clothing is the same way. Mm-hmm. You want those 27 pairs of jeans, but do you need 27 pairs of jeans? Mm-hmm. What you can afford and what you want and need are all independent. I've learned when I needed a minivan, I did not want the minivan. Definitely did not want a minivan, but I needed one.
Yeah.
And so I bought one and now I love it. But you have to recognize what you want versus what you actually
need.
And appreciate what you have.
Yeah.
I mean, I still wear a 30-year-old rain jacket. My family's like, it doesn't even fit you anymore. Just get another one. I'm like, I spent $300 on this in 1996.
I'm going to get the most out of it.
And it still works.
And plus two, they don't make them like they used to.
True. They do not make them like they used to. And L.L. Bean will guarantee just about anything. So, I still have my rain jacket.
Mm-hmm. I'm a big fan of L.L. Bean.
Yeah.
Be proud of your accomplishments, not ashamed of your failures. I love that one.
That's a big one because everyone fails. Everyone fails at something. Mm-hmm. They just don't maybe publicize it. You don't hear about it, but everybody fails at something. And even if it's a little thing, be proud of it.
Keep going.
I left that trail at 1 mile an hour. And the people that were hiking at 4 miles an hour were like, look at her. Mm-hmm. And I was like, yeah. But I just was at a shelter for 12 days and I'm walking out. I was really proud of that.
Yeah. That's amazing. Slow down and enjoy life.
I need to remind myself of that lately. Life is meant to be lived and enjoyed. It's not just, 90 miles an hour down the interstate. It's enjoy your kids, enjoy your family, enjoy your pets, enjoy your friends, smell the flowers. Mm-hmm. I'm terrible. I was that mom that would let the kids, play on the balance beam on the curb in front of the library or something. And to this day, I'll stop and I will smell flowers. And people are like, come on, let's go. We're in a hurry. I'm like, I'm smelling the flowers.
Right.
So.
Appreciate it.
You have to appreciate what's around you.
Have confidence and find your power.
Everybody has their own superpower.
Mm-hmm.
You don't know what it is. Not everybody knows what it is, but you have to find it.
Yeah.
And you find it in all different ways. But you just have to find it.
Mm-hmm.
So.
That's amazing. So those are all the lessons you learned on the Appalachian Trail and throughout the rest of your life. Because you said, a lot of it came back to you over the years.
Right. A lot of these things you don't realize till you've been living for a while, and then you realize, oh, I learned that from the trail. I learned that on the Appalachian Trail. Oh, I learned to appreciate this while I was on the Appalachian Trail.
And writing the book probably was all a bunch of new lessons learned, too, in yourself, because you got to push yourself.
I ended up hiring a coach to help me because this book has been sitting on my shelf since 2007.
Mm-hmm.
And it just sat there, and it was 450 pages and not written properly, and I didn't have time to edit.
Mm-hmm.
So somehow, with the power of LinkedIn, I got connected to a writing coach, and she was looking for people to write a chapter in an anthology.
Mm-hmm.
And for some reason, I just said, I could do that. Like, I've never written anything published before in my life. But with her help, I said, I really want to talk about this.
Mm-hmm.
So I did. I wrote a chapter. And after all the coaching, once that book got published, she said, when are you going to write your story? And I said, I don't have time. I run a cleaning business. I have teenage kids. And she says, you need to write your story. I want to learn about it. I said, well, I already told you about it. She said, you told me about it. But there's a whole world out there. And at first I said, there's a million books on the Appalachian Trail. What would make mine different? And she said, because it's your story.
Exactly, yeah.
And I said, okay. So with her help, she kept me on track. I was forced to write, and we would go over things. And With her help and her forcing me, you know, I picked my time. I would write from 11 p.m. when everybody else went to bed. And sometimes I'd write for 15 minutes and sometimes I'd write for 3 hours. Mm-hmm. My staff at April Fresh Cleaning was very helpful. You know, I'm like, yeah, guys, I went to bed at 4 o'clock in the morning. I'm not coming in till the afternoon. They're mm-hmm. like, don't worry about it. We got the office. Get mm-hmm. some sleep. So they were very instrumental in keeping April Fresh Cleaning running mm-hmm. while I was writing this.
Mm-hmm. So. And where can people find the book?
It is on Amazon and all major retailers online, but it's also in person at North Shore Bookstore. And I just dropped a copy off at Crandall Library.
Oh, I heard about that. Yep. So from that meeting. See, the power of the Women's Business Council
and the power of chamber and networking. And so Crandall Library has a copy as of today.
So thank you very much, April Wiegand of April Fresh Cleaning and author of Trail Gimp, Self-Discovery and Empowerment on the Appalachian Trail.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Great to have you.